You can check out our website at theeerytouch.com for our source materials and reference photos for each episode. You can find this podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google, and our YouTube channel. Be sure to follow us, The Eerie Touch, on Facebook for new leads and updates. And we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a 5-star review on whatever platform you listen to your podcast on. It would really help us out. Hey y'all, I'm your host Gabrielle. Welcome to The Eerie Touch, where every week we dive into all things murder, mystery, and paranormal. And guess what? I'm an aunt! Kayla gave birth to a beautiful, sweet baby boy named Elijah last Friday. So she's going to be taking some time off, and until she can get situated with him and everything, you're going to be hanging out with me. And a special guest who is in law enforcement himself, my husband, Alan.
Hey guys, I'm excited to be here. Long time listener, first time caller. but I am especially excited to talk about this case. We've heard a lot about, and it still comes up a lot in conversation around here.
Yes. A case that entails a small town girl with dreams of being whisked away from her troublesome life by a handsome Prince Charming. But when her knight in shining armor turns out to be a villain in disguise, her world comes crashing down as he cuts every last string that held up her hopes for a better future. Permanently. This is the slaying of Susan Daniels Smith. Susan was born in 1961 in a little town in West Virginia called Matewan to Sidney Daniels, who was a former coal miner, and Tracy Daniels, who was a housekeeper. Susan was the fifth out of their 9 children. Due to her father becoming unemployed, the family picks up and moves to Freeburn, Kentucky when Susan was still a baby.
And just as a side note, Freeburn is right outside of Matewan. It's maybe a 10-minute drive.
It's there that she attended Freeburn grade school, but due to financial problems within the family, Susan ends up dropping out in 7th grade.
Which was fairly common in those days, but don't assume that she was unintelligent. Teachers and people that knew Susan said that she loved to read. Even in her adulthood, she was a regular at the local library, checking out books to further her wits. The librarian back then said that she would come in and ask what books she should read to stay current. I think it's safe to say that tells you a little bit about her. She had a want for learning and continuing her education. That's a key component that a lot of us, as we get older, just don't have.
Mm-hmm. Well, while Susan stayed committed to her love of books, in 1977, she met a man named Kenneth Smith. Kenneth was a local dope dealer. He sold meth and PCP, cocaine. He was 22 at the time, while Susan was only 15. And when you're 15, you are very impressionable. Not only that, but gullible. To me, this marks the beginning of her troubles. The couple ends up marrying in the late 70s, not too long after their marriage became official. On November 27th of 1979, Kenneth ends up in jail due to his illegal activities. By the mid-1980s, Susan had given birth to 2 of their children together. When Kenneth returned home sometime later after being released from jail, their relationship had taken a quick turn for the worse. Their marriage became destructive, compromised by drug abuse and physical abuse.
You know, it's sad to say, but we see this every day. It's becoming more common, and almost like yin and yang. You can't have one without the other. When you have 2 people who get addicted to drugs, you're bound to have problems somewhere.
They definitely had the problems. So much so that they eventually end up getting a divorce. Although, they still ended up living together. I'm sure because of finances and the children. It's pretty common for couples to quote-unquote stay together, just for the sake of their kids. Anyways, moving on to the year of 1987, which is when this tale begins. A 32-year-old ex-convict and well-known bank robber, Carl Edward Lockhart, also known as Cat Eyes, was a very wanted man. He had robbed numerous banks while threatening employees with a firearm. Now that is bound to get you on authorities' radar.
Yeah, I would say so. Was Cat Eyes from Freeburn, the local area?
He was from Pike County.
Okay, okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, he was, honey. He was on their radar. The FBI had been keeping a close eye on old Cat Eyes. All they needed was some for sure evidence. When Pike County Sheriff Deputy Burt Hatfield heard they were looking for someone who could help them out, he immediately thought of Susan, who he had kind of become friends with due to calls on her ex-husband, and they lived near each other.
Okay, but why Susan, though? What was the connection there?
Well, you see, Cat Eyes was pretty good friends with Susan's ex-husband, Kenneth. He was known to buy dope off of Kenneth and hung out at their house pretty frequently. So who better than the woman of that house?
Okay, so Susan's ex-husband, Kenneth, would typically hang out with Cat Eyes?
Cat Eyes hung out with Kenneth.
Okay, Cat Eyes hang out with Kenneth. Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming they would buy drugs together, do drugs together.
Probably, okay. Yeah. So Burt recommends working with the FBI to Susan. He knew what state she was in regarding her relationship and financial status, so he thought this would be a good way for her to make some extra money for her and her kids.
Even though becoming an informant around here, it's pretty common. When working with local police, the pay really isn't that great. But when you're an informant with the FBI, the cash can get much higher. And it becomes a lot more steady money than it is with local police. Therefore, it's pretty hard to pass up.
I was about to say, it's probably more common for people to accept that deal with FBI than not. It was just too good of a deal for Susan to pass up. Ultimately, she follows through on the deal that she made and starts laying down the footwork to put Cat Eyes behind bars in the spring of 1987. The agent on Cat Eyes' case was Mark Putnam. Mark was raised working class, but he had more upper class-like opportunities throughout his upbringing. He grew up in Connecticut and snagged a partial soccer scholarship to a college prep school. After his high school graduation, Mark attended college in Florida at the University of Tampa, and then moved back home where he completed and graduated from the FBI Academy. Shortly after his graduation, him and his wife Kathy, whose father was a very wealthy real estate developer, began a family and both worked entry-level jobs. Though Mark yearned to prove himself to the FBI in hopes of one day moving up in rank, he was known to be a hard worker and a smart one at that. When he was located to Pikeville, Kentucky in 1987 to help catch Cat Eyes, he knew what steps he needed to take to make his desires come full effect. He made sure to befriend the local police to have his name in good light.
Which was actually unusual back then, because local police agencies were pretty wary of working with the FBI. They were well known to be a little distant, and that rubbed a lot of the local officers the wrong way. They were typically seen as outsiders.
Mark knew that. He made sure to go the extra mile to do a lot for police, and in doing so, he did a lot not just for his reputation, but the police as well. Mark was now known as a trusting lawman in the community. So when he was first introduced to Susan, she was under the impression that he was a good man. But she soon realized that that was a mistake. Mark and Susan began to have frequent contact while they discussed the information and criminal plans that she was finding out on Cat Eyes. Carl Lockhart was eventually arrested in December of 1987. And in January of 1988, he was sentenced to 45 years in federal prison. As promised, Susan received a hefty $5,000 for her contribution to the case.
Which $5,000, I don't know about y'all, would be pretty good for me. But even in today's currency, that would equal out to about $11,000.
That is a lot of moolah, baby.
And it was well deserved. It really was. Susan gave testimony and information that really helped secure the conviction.
For sure earned. Now this is where things become more like he said, she said. According to Mark, his contact with Susan dwindled down after Lockhart's case was closed. However, even with Mark being transferred to Miami to work on other projects, Susan kept contact with Mark. By mid-1988, they began to have an active sexual relationship, to which Mark proclaims only lasted a few months. But according to Susan's family and close friends, She told them that the affair went on for almost 2 years, which was about the same amount of time that Mark was in Pike County. To hear him tell it, Susan was the one chasing him, but let me tell you something. You'll never make me believe that she was chasing him and that he wasn't egging it on.
Yeah, for sure. But if they had a 2-year relationship just working on this case, you're going to get close. You're going to become friends, to say the least.
Yeah.
Not saying that couldn't have developed into more, maybe on her side, maybe not so much on his side. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. It could have been, it was all in her imagination.
But doubtful.
I find that kind of hard to believe.
Right.
Spending so much time together, working on the case, contact, close contact. It's hard to believe that it was just a fling, as he's kind of putting it.
Right. Well, in actuality, the affair deepened as Susan became more apparent in Mark's life. He had given Susan his phone number, both before and after being transferred to Miami. He had even become so ballsy that he introduced his wife, Kathy, to Susan, and they actually become friends. Kathy recalled her friendship with Susan in the beginning as one-sided, saying that she offered emotional support to Susan as she would talk to Kathy about her drug use, the abuse, you know, that her ex-husband was giving her, and her financial problems because of everything. But eventually, Kathy found herself really taking a liking to Susan. And as time progressed, this unlikely friendship ended up becoming two-sided. Kathy was growing so close to Susan that she was talking to her about her hardships of feeling isolated and alone from moving to a new place and not knowing anyone. Kathy had even come out and said that Susan, at one point, admitted her love for Mark, but Kathy just didn't think too much of it at the time, claiming she thought it was just wishful thinking.
Wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Okay, I can understand. I can understand Kathy meeting Susan, mm-hmm. knowing her history, you know, kind of reaching out as a friend. You know, she was a recovering addict,
mm-hmm.
wanting to be her friend. I'm sure her husband had probably spoke to his wife multiple times about her, you know, such a poor girl, you know, she just really needs help. She's a really great girl. So I can see Kathy wanting to befriend her and even bringing up to the point to where, you know, that she admits that she has feelings for her husband and everything else. That's not typically uncommon. But I can kind of see her kind of blowing it off. It's like, yeah, he is a great guy. Hopefully you'll find one like him someday.
Right. Well, one thing is for sure that is still true to this day. Girls tell their girlfriends everything.
Always.
Yes. So Susan, she was in love. She told her friends and family about her relationship, and she described it as passionate. That Mark was this smooth talker that whisked her off her feet. That he was so romantic. And he portrayed to Susan that he was head over heels in love for her. They would meet up to have sex in hotels, cars, and even Mark's own home that he shared with his wife. Now, I'm saying that for the audacity of it, not because I'm surprised. Men will do a lot of idiotic things when it comes to what they want. No offense, honey.
Easy now. Men are pretty stupid. but no offense taken, honey.
Well, I personally think that Mark was attempting to cover his tracks at this point. You know what I mean? Like maybe if he brought Susan in to be friends with Kathy, you know, Kathy would be less likely to believe that he was having an affair with her. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah. Well, Mark has tried to say that they only had sex a couple of times in his car, but you and I, along with most who are very familiar with the case, know that that turned out to be a lie.
I would say so. He told his wife that this is what happened, that they'd only met a couple of times. Happened in the car.
No, he told the police.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, you're going to
downplay. Yeah, at this point, Kathy doesn't know.
Okay, yeah, you're going to downplay as much as you can. Yeah, we did have sex. Yeah, it was only a couple of times.
Right.
They're never going to give the full details.
Yeah. Well, moving on. In December of 1988, Susan allegedly stopped using contraceptives in order to get pregnant. According to Mark, he was slowly coming aware that this affair could lead to a horrible outcome for his career and his family. In early 1989, he signed a petition to permanently be transferred to Florida in order to focus on other cases and end the affair that once and for all.
Okay, it sounds like things were starting to catch up with him. He probably felt like he was getting boxed in. And it's better to try to distance himself from that, you know, like, this never happened, this is never going to happen again.
Yeah. I think that's exactly what it was. I think Susan just happened to be the one that fell hard for Mark. Local rumors spread throughout the area that Susan wasn't the only woman occupying his bed. Reddit user KittyCat40 professes that Mark was also having an affair with a local teacher in Pikeville that she had actually babysat for when she was younger. KittyCat40 vows that she knows for a fact when the story broke, the accused teacher was questioned by authorities due to the allegations of the affair. Now, years later, a friend of KittyCat40 confirmed that she was questioned and that the teacher was sleeping with Mark.
So, how does she know that? For sure. A lot of people love to gossip.
That's true, but she says that her source is her friend's mother, who was good friends with this said teacher.
I wouldn't be surprised either way.
Me either. Still, though, in mid-1989, Mark returned to Pike County to complete an unrelated investigation, and surprise, surprise.
So he returned to Pike County? Let me guess. He gets back in contact with Susan.
Yep. Well, he says she contacted him, but it was probably planned. I mean, the entire time that he was in Florida, he stayed in contact with Susan. That's a fact. So I'm pretty sure that this was already talked about in some shape, way, or form. Like, they probably discussed meeting up, but maybe hadn't set anything in stone until he got down here. So when he does meet up with Susan, she ends up telling him that she's pregnant.
But was she really pregnant, or was she just trying to hook him back in?
Well, according to online sources, Susan had actually went to the health department, and it was there that she received a positive pregnancy test. On June 8th of 1989, Susan finds herself in Mark's car to talk about the pregnancy. They drive to an isolated spot so no one else will see them together, and Mark is not wanting to have this baby or commit to Susan. He offers to pay for her an abortion, to which she, of course, declines. He then decides to insult her even more by telling her that she can have the baby, but him and Kathy will raise it together without her being in the picture. Now, of course, Susan is pissed at this point, like most women would be. She starts calling Kathy foul names and cursing Mark for what he has done and what he has led her to believe. She threatens to tell Kathy and all of his co-workers just what scum he really is when all of a sudden, he snaps. Of course, we don't know for sure what happened because Susan's not here to tell us, so we're going off of how Mark described his last evening with her. He completely loses it, he says. He ends up beating Susan relentlessly, so much so that the windshield in his rental car burst. Well, bust. Susan is fighting for her life. She's scratching and grasping at whatever she can get a hold of to break free from Mark's grip. However, the altercation only comes to a stop when he wraps his hands around her neck and begins to squeeze. He strangles Susan until the life leaves her eyes. Sadly, though, he isn't finished with her yet. After he murders Susan, he stuffs her in the trunk of his rental car and returns to his hotel. The following day, he had to be at FBI headquarters in Lexington, Kentucky, which is about a 2-hour drive from Pikeville.
Okay, so he strangles her,
mm-hmm.
stuffs her in the trunk,
mm-hmm.
goes back to his hotel
mm-hmm.
with her in the trunk,
yep.
leaves the next day and drives to Lexington from Pikeville with her still in the trunk?
Yep, with her still in the trunk. And may I mind you, it's the middle of summer and it is hot, people.
See, now I can't even imagine.
Nobody wants to imagine that. So he then returns back to his hotel after he makes it to Lexington and back. While Mark was there, another FBI agent had noticed some scratches on Mark. He had one on his hand, one on his neck, and a scratch going down his eye. In an effort to hide what he had ultimately done, he tells the agent that his house in Pikeville still hasn't sold. Therefore, he had gone by to do some upgrades to the house in the hopes that it would help sell it. In the process, he had scratched himself trying to renovate what he could.
And the other agents believed him?
I guess so.
Okay. I can give a little bit on that. You're doing renovations on your house. You get a couple scratches on your hand. Maybe possibly on your neck. It depends on how detailed you are and what you're doing. But the neck and the eye, that would be kind of questionable for me. I don't know that I could believe that.
Yeah, I don't think I would either. And honestly, who knows what the other agent truly thought, because later on, locals and others who know the case stay hell-bent on the FBI trying to cover up somewhat for Mark, but we'll get into that in a minute. So Mark fiddles his thumbs all day trying to come up with a plan to get rid of Susan's body. He ends up settling on an old coal mining road that isn't used anymore. As if he hadn't already done enough, he strips Susan of not just her clothing, but what little dignity she had left, and dumps her body in a ditch on that road. He later states to authorities that there was actually a woman riding a horse nearby that saw him, so he quickly pretends that he pulled off real quick on the side of the road to empty his bladder. Afterwards, he cleans the car thoroughly and changes rental cars. Now, he gives them the excuse of a coal truck losing some coal while he was driving behind it, and that's what busted the windshield. Afterwards, he goes back to Miami as if nothing ever happened. Later on, Susan's sister Shelby, who she was really close to, and Mark's co-worker Ron Poole get to talking when Shelby hadn't heard from her sister in a bit. Ron attempts to talk to Mark for the sake of Shelby's worries, and Mark tells him, "Yeah, I saw Susan, but we just talked for a minute about her being pregnant, and that's it. I haven't heard from her since, and I don't know if her going anywhere. Maybe she should just report her missing."
Oh, wow. So, he takes her up a road, drops her in a ditch.
Yeah.
Does he cover the body? Do we know?
No. He just left her
so
there.
So, he strips her clothing off, drops her in a ditch.
Yep.
After strangling her, which is really up close and personal. Typically, when it's someone you actually care about, whether it's accidental, usually even in a crime of passion, you still have some feelings for them.
Yeah.
So you'll try to respectfully hide the body. Let's put it that way.
That's a good point.
You'll cover them with a sheet. You'll cover them with leaves or something like that. But just to dump her in a ditch, and to just run off and leave and act like nothing ever happened, that says a lot about him. It really does.
I think so too. But honey, I'm not even finished yet. After asking around Susan's social circle, it came about that she had been thinking about going up north to get some drugs.
For herself or to do more informant work?
I'm pretty sure it was to do some more work for the FBI. According to friends, she had been considering it for the last 4 weeks. She just hadn't jumped right into it yet because she was pregnant, and you, out of all people, know how risky working with the feds can be.
That's true. But I can see her saying that she wants to go do more drug work for the feds because they do pay good money for it.
Yeah.
But you never know how the person you're zoned in on will react if they find out someone is breaking their trust.
I'm not sure where exactly these allegations were coming from or who was giving them the impression, but they have been stated by police that at first they thought maybe she had just run away. Susan did have a troubling past and troubling life. She had actually ran off a few times prior to everything happening, but I can't help but sit here and wonder, you know, you hear about all of these missing persons and it seems police are always so quick to jump in to the they ran away theory. Why is that?
And I can understand that. She was how old at the time?
28.
She was 28. She had a history of a drug problem. She had ran away several times before. like it or not, police probably thought that she had just moved on elsewhere. Not saying that that's right, and you know that they shouldn't have jumped on it right off the gun, but mm-hmm. it's a grown adult with a history of running away, so it's not unheard of.
Right. Okay. Well, that wasn't the only theory they had. Authorities also factored in that Susan could have been murdered, but not by Mark, obviously.
Well, not at this point.
Yeah. Due to their toxic and abusive marriage, police questioned Kenneth. But he stayed adamant that he had nothing to do with Susan's disappearance. He was actually pretty torn up about it. He still believed that Susan and him could work things out and get back together, which you would normally believe. I mean, they have this on-again, off-again history with each other. They have two children together, and they both live under the same roof. You see people stay in abusive relationships every day with the hopes of change.
Yeah, but it's actually pretty typical. There's been studies done that show that partners in an abusive relationship, it will take usually about seven times before they'll finally leave.
Seven times?
Yeah, seven times. That's normally the national average. We deal with it multiple times. Beg, plead, you know, yeah. Move on and do something else. And we're kids involved. I'm sure it makes it harder to actually get away.
Right.
But they do finally get to the point where they've had enough. And hopefully it's before anything really, really bad happens.
Right. Okay. Regardless, they cross Kenneth off their list and move on to Cat Eye. He was known as a man who wasn't afraid to take a life, and with most criminals, narking on them can get you killed. Kentucky State Police go to question Cat Eye in prison to see if he had sent word to someone to have Susan knocked off. But Cat Eye tells them as much as he would have loved to have her finished, it wasn't him. So they just move on. I mean, how does that work? Do y'all just take a criminal's word at face value?
I'm sure they knew all of Cat Eye's known associates, probably followed up with them. More than likely had good alibis for them, so that can always lead to a dead end.
Alright. Well, with no one else under suspicion, Kentucky State Police discover through friends and family about Susan's affair with Mark. They go straight to the FBI wanting full cooperation from them to question Mark. And the FBI agrees and flies Mark back to Pike County. While under interrogation, Mark admits that they were having an affair, but denies knowing anything about her whereabouts. But when doing so, he says a couple of things that alert police. He talks of Susan in past tense. Even though at this point, she's still a missing person, Kentucky State Police are in no way investigating this as a murder yet.
And I'm sure that threw up a lot of red flags. Anytime you talk of someone, even a friend, especially with a relationship like they had, which I'm sure they found out, you know, there was a more involved relationship than he was letting on.
Yeah.
Anytime you talk of anyone in the past tense, is never a good sign, because they're not going to tell him that she's dead or they think she's dead, but he's already speaking of that she's already dead.
Right. Okay, so when you're doing an interrogation, what are some key things that y'all look for when you're doing an interrogation with someone, or some key things that, you know, you zone in on to think like, oh, okay, something's not right here with this one?
Especially if it's somebody you're involved with, if you speak of them as in the past tense, or you talk of them in a derogatory tone, like, you know, pardon my language, but you know, well, that bitch, or you know, if it's someone you love, you know, it's gonna be, oh, my girlfriend, my wife,
yeah,
you know, everything like that. You're not gonna speak in the past tense,
and you're not gonna be derogatory.
You're not gonna be derogatory, you know, especially if it's someone you love, you admire.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the police are already weary of Mark, but just to see, they ask him if he would be willing to take a lie detector test. Even though these are inadmissible in court, he agrees and fails tremendously. But you know, if the results of taking a lie detector test aren't accepted as evidence in a courtroom, why do authorities still use them? Like, what's the purpose?
It'll help point us in the right direction. It'll give us questions. Whatever the questions are asked that they actually fail, that are questions we'll hit a little bit harder on, because more than likely they're lying about it. So you try to dig a little bit deeper into those questions and to finally get to the truth.
So it kind of like it points you in a direction. It can give you a direction to be pointed in.
It gives us directions on what questioning to actually follow on,
yeah,
to follow up with, or to add to.
Okay. Well, days go by, and Mark, along with his attorney by his side, take a plea for a shorter sentence with the promise of federal prison instead of state, as he comes in to confess to the slaying of Susan Daniel Smith. As part of that plea bargain, he informs authorities as to where they can find Susan's body. And it's up that old coal mining road they finally find Susan and are able to lay her to rest peacefully. Mark Putnam receives 16 years in prison, while his wife, Kathy, stood by his side the entire time through the whole ordeal. Her mother, Carol, stated in an interview with the LA Times that he was a wonderful man and that it was just a crime of passion. Just a crime of passion. Like, ma'am, your son-in-law was cheating on your daughter and got his mistress knocked up and killed her, and that's your definition of a good man?
Well, her and her husband were rich. You know how some people in the upper class are conditioned. They look past certain things in order to retain their status.
Well, I know, but like, damn, come on, people. How can you defend a man like that? And to upset you even more, he ends up only serving 10 of those 16 years. In 2000, Mark was released on good behavior and was described as a model inmate from guards. But of course he would be a model inmate. He's in prison. He's this pretty boy who was probably lucky to have lasted as long as he did in there. You know, when it comes to certain crimes, I just don't believe that early release should even be a possibility. Do you?
No, in no way should early release on something like this have even been an option. Even the 16 years, I think, was too lenient.
So how much would, okay, if you were a judge, how much would you have given?
I don't. Do you remember what he was charged with? What he actually pled to?
I think it was just first degree murder. Or first, maybe first, second. No. It was like they were trying to do it as a crime of passion.
Yeah, probably felony murder.
Yeah.
It could have been manslaughter, which is why it would have been a little bit lower. I would think at least felony murder. But even then, you're usually not eligible for parole. I think it's in the state of West Virginia for 15 years. Mm-hmm. But you're eligible. That's when you're eligible. Typically, you don't get paroled on when your first parole comes up. It's highly unusual. But being a model prisoner does help. It can cut time off your sentence. But to me, 10 years after a murder of a pregnant lady.
Well, see, that's, I wanted to bring that up too. See, I couldn't find like really anywhere online, like, you know, they were just talking about the murder of Susan. Isn't there like, you know, like if you kill a pregnant woman, isn't like, can't you get charged twice, like with two different things, because you killed a woman plus you killed an unborn baby?
There is laws of that on the books. Whether that was actually even enacted back then, that may not have been statute back then. And even then, it's state to state.
Well, I don't agree with that. I think that's crap.
But also, I mean, she laid there in a ditch for a year in the open, decomposing. Maybe the ME couldn't verify that she was actually pregnant.
Well, see, that's another thing.
I don't
too.
Know. I'm no expert on that, so I can't verify one way or another, right, if that's even possible.
Well, that was another thing. Like I had mentioned earlier about, you know, people who are familiar with the case, they, you know, go on. They are very adamant in believing that, you know, the FBI helped Marker was too lenient on Mark. They had, you know, what's the word? They had pull. Yeah, they had pull.
The family had money.
Yeah.
So, of course, they're going to hire him the best attorney and try to do everything. And of course, if they had that much pull, there's political powers that could have been in play. I don't know. I'm just speculating.
Right. Well, people also speculate that the FBI was too lenient on Mark because he was the first FBI agent to have at least got caught murdering someone like this and this type of thing. There was also theories, you know, people have came out, I think it was in some news article that I had read that, what is it? EMTs or whatever they're called, pathologists?
Mm-hmm.
That whenever they were looking at her body, they hadn't found any signs of a fetus. Now, this was just a couple years ago because when they first discovered Susan, they had started to do an autopsy and stuff on her. And Susan's family had actually came in and stopped it because they didn't want anything done. I think they were just so traumatized by everything. They just wanted it not done. They ended up like getting, what's it called again? When you unbury someone.
Exhumed.
Yeah, they ended up exhuming her body a couple years ago. And they were talking about how they hadn't found a fetus. But then again, you know, you've been, pardon being so morbid, but you've been deceased for that long, you know, and if you were just a couple months pregnant, the bones and stuff probably hadn't even formed on the baby, so.
And again, you know, being so early on in her pregnancy, I don't know. I'm no expert. I don't know that there would be anything.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, I agree. Adequately, Susan's family, they weren't happy with the outcome of everything, though, either. They were upset that the plea wasn't discussed with them first. And I was under the impression that if a plea was on the table, it was the victim's family who had the decision to give the perpetrator that deal or not. Is it not like that?
Not necessarily every time, but you would think in a murder case that it would be discussed with the family to actually agree if this would be a good plea deal for them. I've said on a few cases to where the family just wants to get it over and done with because it's a long process. That, you know, once you get to trial, it is a long process and it just keeps bringing back bad memories.
Yeah, but in this case, they weren't even, the family, what it was for them even
to
discussed.
Not even, for them to not even be brought into the discussion, it's really unusual. To me, it is.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's crap. I think that they should have been, because in the end, they're victims too. Their loved one was taken away from them, and I believe that they should have the right to have some sort of decision when it comes to giving the guilty options that affect them as well.
And I've said on many to where the victims or the victim's family do have a right to speak on the deceased's behalf. Yeah, to weigh in to the judge of what a terrible crime this is, what punishment they would recommend, typically a little harsher, and of course there's always the ones who forgive and you know want to do what's right, you know, in their opinion, to where they don't think that it should be as bad as it should be, but for them to not even be brought into the conversation is just unusual.
Yeah. Well, Mark's wife, Kathy, wouldn't live to see the day of her husband coming back home. She passed away in 1998 due to organ failure because of alcoholism. Mark was 41 years old in 2000 and upon release moved to Georgia where he remarried and was working as a personal trainer. It seems even after everything that Mark Putnam did, his family and friends still defend his actions till this day. In an interview with the LA Times, Mark's brother Tim comments, "We don't make it a secret what he did. We just prefer not to bring it out. I just wish it would all die down, really. The family's been through a lot this year."
The family's been through a whole lot. And then I'm sure it was probably rough on his mother.
Who cares?
I'm sure it was, you know, rough on his brother.
Huh?
But
I
It's not something that should just die down and go away and pretend it never happened.
No, because I feel like that his brother was just sitting here like, you know, oh, look at my family. We're, you know, oh, pity me, pity me.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree with you there. I agree with you there. But in the end, it's more about the victim.
Exactly.
Than it is the actual confessed murder.
Yeah.
It's not like he was locked up and thrown away with the key thrown away and, you know, no evidence. He confessed to murdering her. He confessed mm-hmm. to choking her to death and mm-hmm. dropping her in a ditch.
Mm-hmm. Like, I am not trying to be friends with this man's family. Like, every single one of them, their actions and what and their words and everything just scream like, ugh, to me.
I don't know what to say on that.
Just lie. Well, in the fullness of time, a young woman lost her life at the age of only 28. Because she loved the wrong man too hard. A baby lost a life of endless possibilities and successes, all because one man couldn't stand up to be a man. Again, I'm your host, Gabrielle.
And I'm Alan.
We'll talk next week.